This week, the Black Archives of Mid-America are celebrating their grand opening. Here in Kansas City, they serve to collect and preserve the history of African Americans in the Midwest and offer educational programs and research services to facilitate scholarly inquiry and public understanding of Black history. It's important stuff. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll speak with one of the nation's leading figures in the cultural historical community. She's been involved in projects from the Smithsonian's National Museum to African burial grounds in New York to the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. We'll hear about the place of history in our local communities and ask you, where have you learned the most about African American history? Is there a museum or historic site that has left an impression on you? That's coming up today on Central Standard following this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The House Government Oversight Committee is discussing holding Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. Committee Chairman Daryl Issa says Holder has not provided additional requested documents on a botched gun smuggling probe.
The subpoenas are 8 months old. We have not received a credible reason for them not being supplied. And in fact, no constitutional assertion has occurred.
The White House has invoked executive privilege regarding the documents. New York Democrat Carolyn Maloney says she is horrified that the committee is considering holding the Attorney General in contempt.
The Attorney General is being attacked for protecting documents that he is prohibited by law from producing.
Holder wants certain assurances that he and ISA have not been able to agree on so far, including another briefing with Congress. A recount begins today in a race that will decide which party controls the Wisconsin State Senate. As Marty Michelson from member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports, the Republican incumbent requested the retally.
An official canvas shows Republican State Senator Van Wongaard lost the recall election to Democratic challenger John Lehman by more than 800 votes. Wongaard asked for the recount last week, and his campaign will pay for it. The recount will begin this morning, and Racine County has until July 2nd to complete it. The Wisconsin Senate currently has 16 Democrats and 16 Republicans. The winner will give his party majority control, at least until the November elections. For NPR News, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
The Nigerian Red Cross says it has counted 40 bodies and 62 people wounded in clashes in the northern city of Kaduna. NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton says the Red Cross also reports more than 20 people killed in 2 days of violence in another Nigerian town.
First came Kaduna State, which was rocked by 3 deadly explosions during church services last Sunday. The volatile northeastern Nigerian town of Damaturu was the next to be hit. Radical Islamist Boko Haram insurgents have claimed responsibility for the Kaduna bombings. Police say suspected members of the sect launched multiple attacks on police and military institutions in Damaturu a day after the Kaduna explosions. Last November, Boko Haram said it was behind bombings and shootings in Damaturu that left more than 100 people dead. The group's name translates from Hausa as Western education is sinful. Ophebia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Dakar.
Stocks are down slightly this morning. The Dow down 12, the Nasdaq down 3. Investors waiting on news from the Federal Reserve meeting, which winds up today. This is NPR News. U.S. officials say as many as 3 U.S. troops have been killed in a suicide bombing in eastern Afghanistan. Reports say more than a dozen Afghans were also killed. The Pentagon says it is not clear whether the bomber aimed at a military convoy, although there are some reports saying so. Archaeologists in Australia have discovered cave paintings dating back nearly 30,000 years. As Stuart Cohen reports from Sydney, it's some of the oldest artwork ever found.
The Aboriginal rock art was discovered last year by researchers excavating a cave in the Arnhem Land region of Australia's Northern Territory. But it wasn't until just now that carbon dating confirmed the paintings are roughly 28,000 years old. That makes them the oldest dated rock art in Australia. The world's oldest art was discovered in a cave in Spain, where hand stencils have been dated as more than 40,000 years old. A professor from the team from the University of Southern Queensland calls the site one of the biggest Aboriginal art galleries in Australia. He says there's evidence that the cave where the discovery was made was first used by humans 45,000 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
Greece has a new prime minister today. Antonis Samaras heads the conservative New Democracy Party. New Democracy supports Greece's bailout agreements with its debtors. Now it will lead a coalition to uphold the agreements while simultaneously trying to resolve massive budget imbalances and reverse plummeting employment. A new poll shows that if the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down the health care law, Americans overwhelmingly want the president and Congress to come up with another one. The poll was conducted by the Associated Press and GFK. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of public radio listeners all across America who support their NPR member stations.
Good morning, Kansas City. The ground is broken on the building of the National Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian in Washington. In the same year, the Black Archives of Mid-America has reopened here in Kansas City. What remains now for both institutions is charting the course of those who break new ground every day in every field of human endeavor. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director for Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian Institution for the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jabalani, and thank you for having me.
In celebration of the grand opening of the Black Archives, as I just mentioned, Dr. Mack will be speaking at the Gym Theater at 1615 18th Street tonight at 6 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. More info is on our website at kcur.org. Tell us about the work, Dr. Mack, you do at the museum.
I'm part of course, a much larger team, and I'm very happy to be here today to really talk about some of the work that we are doing. While the museum is going to be a large institution in Washington, D.C., we are only part of a much larger network that stretches from the past and into the present, and much of our work is collaborative with institutions like the Black Archives of Mid-America. We have already had programs. We began in 2006 with programs and collaborations, and we go around the country. We also are planning to continue that in the future.
So right now you're in sort of the funding and staffing and logistics phase of the museum evolution.
Absolutely. But we are also, we have a series of traveling exhibitions which we've already developed and which have traveled around the country. In fact, one or two of them are traveling overseas into South America, into Europe by demand. We have education programs where we go to communities around the country. Our Treasures program, for instance, which is really working with local institutions to invite local publics to better take care of their personal collections, their family collections, the legacies that they've inherited from family members and others. These are all treasures, African-American treasures of oral, material, philosophical, spiritual culture. And we share that responsibility in preserving those treasures and making them accessible for everyone in the future.
You come from a consultative background and have been over the years a museum consultant. What does a museum consultant do? What do they add to the museum process and the curatorial process?
My original background really is as an academic. I did university teaching and then worked within museums. Working outside of museums has been fabulous because I had a chance to work with a wide variety of different types of institutions around the country and look at all kinds of different work being done. What I think a museum consultant, and there are different types of specializations, can do is really bring some of the best professional practice to an ongoing endeavor. Not every organization has to reinvent the wheel. There are some, in a sense, best practice standards that really help towards sustainability, fundraising, long-term success.
What are some of the basic best practices? What is in all the museum recipes?
You know, one of the big challenges in African-American cultural practice now is that we're going through a huge generational change. The founding generations from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even 1980s, the founders of many of those organizations were operating with different requirements, different standards, and it's, although overlapping vision, different vision. Those institutions often had to come into being in opposition to the mainstream. Today, it's a very different scenario in many ways. African American cultural institutions are part and parcel of the larger American framework. The structures, the economy that we operate in has changed also. We need as much business and management and administrative expertise as we do historical content curatorial.
What's changed? You mentioned a generational shift in the attitudes toward maintaining and building cultural institutions.
Many of the founders of our institutions came with a belly, a fire in the belly, with a passion. That has not changed. But they often had the content expertise, the community pulse, et cetera. These days, in order for an organization to not only thrive but survive, you have to bring a business into it. This is not charity. This is these are, in a sense, non-taxed businesses. And that long-term financial sustainability, audience development, these are elements that are fundamental for any kind of cultural institution. And so it's this combination of resources and that understanding of that need from the very beginning, from the inception, as, for instance, the Black Archives here has, that really enhances and assures its long-term viability.
Audience development is definitely key, as you mentioned, cultural institutions of African-American origin moving more into the mainstream consciousness. Tell us about that, the challenges with audience.
Audience challenges for any cultural institution, any museum, including the Smithsonian, is always a factor. The founding generations were in a scenario that I often think of as a FUBU moment, for us, by us.
Right. Popular clothing.
Exactly.
As well.
It was at a time when, again, because of the invisibility or the ignoring of this cultural legacy, mandated that we really work often in opposition with no funding, et cetera, to have that happen. And our audiences very often were the local community, the national community, the African American community writ large. But part of the consequences of a certain amount of success is that this is now perceived as American history and American legacy. And institutions often have to now explain themselves, interpret themselves for audiences who may not know the basic American canon, as it were. When maybe a third of your visitors come from overseas, you have to tell those stories differently, find different ways of connecting with people.
And so how do you feel a National Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian advances the narrative of the African American experience, takes it out of that FUBU, for us, by us moment, and branches out to a broader audience?
Our presence on the National Mall as part of the Smithsonian is something that cannot be ignored. I mean, it's a powerful statement in itself. And we join that national narrative, not in a narrow sense, but in a larger sense. But there's only so much that we can do. We can, from that perspective, tell some of these very large, overarching stories. We can make some of these very broad sweep connections. But there's no way in which, even with 350,000 square feet, we can do everything. One of the seminal, issues around this museum is that it will always be in collaboration with others. And so we can tell certain types of stories, but we also will not be the be-all and end-all. We will, on-site, online, and through programming nationally, redirect our visitors to all the places around the country where they can find more intimate stories, more powerful local stories, more immediate stories with different types of evidence and resources.
And speaking of the sort of centralization of the culture and the narrative with the tentacles and barnacles stretching out to different African-American cultural institutions all around the country, what makes a good exhibit and a good museum? For instance, how do you decide what to include? What's your basic approach?
There are a number of criteria. How big is the story? How seminal or central is the story for people to understand the African-American experience? There are certain kinds of stories that we feel we must tell, and those stories have to be told in many places as well. But also, do we have the means to tell the story? Do we have the collections? Do we have the images? Do we have the voices? Do we have the resources for really what's powerful a particular type of powerful storytelling. Can we tell that story better than others, or should we leave that story to be told by others? Is it a story that really is best told in a museum medium, or is it better as a film? And so there's no one criteria, but there's a range of criteria, and there's continual sort of sifting and shifting and debate among us as a team with our stakeholders, with our constituents. Much of this was, of course, premised by the first 2 years of national listening that we did. The museum went around the country in community workshops, large and small, with organizations such as the Black Archives, who were archivists, and then with general community audiences. And in that listening and documenting, we began to get a sense of the kinds of stories that we felt our publics really wanted to see on, in a sense, a big stage and a big screen, and how they also felt they could partner with us in doing so.
How does the founding of this museum advance African Americans and the larger American populace beyond the legacy of slaves and racial discrimination?
One of our basic tenets, and something which Lonnie Bunch repeatedly reminds not only audiences and listeners, but us as a staff, is that this is an opportunity to cast a certain light, view American history and culture through an African-American lens. It's a different way of looking at this country, its past, its present, its future. It's a different way of it's a unique and probably a very fundamental way of addressing some of the ironies of this country, the basis of this country in terms of liberty and freedom, and yet its fundamental premise for the first 300 years that was in opposite, that did not follow on that promise, that actually tried to restrict that promise. There are many people who have been here 12 or so generations, and others who are new Americans. For themselves and for their children, the way that they can connect to this country is through different ways. And an African-American lens is not just for African-Americans, but for many people to find a way to see the past and to find themselves in the present and to, in a sense, look at opportunities of how they will or won't engage on what terms in the future.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director for Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian. Kansas City, where did you learn most about African-American history and culture? Is there a museum or a book or a speaker or a site or a film that's left an impact on how you see the world? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Marty already writes, the PBS film Eyes on the Prize, that documentary is a good benchmark for him. Also, Daisy Bates' memoir, The Long Shadow of Little Rock. Thank you, Marty, for writing in. Once again, the number is 816-235-2888. Let us know what seminal piece of African-American culture left an impression on you. Dr. Mack, tell us about your career, how you got started, and what made you fascinated with history, artifacts, the stories of our forebears.
I'm an anthropologist by training, and when one is trained as a social scientist, one of the fundamental tenets is that we understand that fact, reality, history are all social constructions. These are not just real or unreal. People choose what they remember and choose what they ignore. One of my fundamental, you know, learning moments in college was reading a book by Berger and Luckman called The Social Construction of Reality. That opened my eyes in realizing that what I was being taught at a university, et cetera, was selected, was constructed by others. And so if I wanted to find ways in which I examined my own community history, et cetera, I had to really look critically all around me and also at my own experience. I think that is a premise that most people in, you know, whatever the field may be, in the arts, in culture, it's sort of deconstructing what's around you and looking at where you get your information, how you determine who you are and who others are, what are the values.
Even going back before your formal education in anthropology and cultural geography, what fascinated you about artifacts, talking little girl, teenager, pre-college. What fascinated you about stories, artifacts, history?
I always wondered, where did these things come from? Who selected them and why? I was also aware, as an African-American child growing up in the south side of Chicago, that what the press said about my community was not what I understood about my community. So I think being aware of the power of objects, the power of stories, very early on, and that there were multiple perspectives, different views about them, was something that I began to put in combination.
We got June in Midtown. Welcome to Central Standard, June.
Hi. What I wanted to share is that as a white person in our culture, for me, it's been a 25-year journey since I was in college of first being able to confront white privilege and oppression and the underclass and class dynamics and that kind of thing, that was actually able to even open me up to a different place of being able to understand and identify with and care about African-American history in a larger context. And like a couple of the influences that really helped me with that is a multimedia 4-hour presentation called American Pictures that was created by a Danish man who traveled through the United States in the 60s and 70s. And he just opened my eyes to a world that I had no awareness of as a white girl from northern parts of the states. And so that was a pivotal moment that opened me to a very different path in life where I care and I'm invested in and consider myself having a stake in the expansion of an inclusion of a broader narrative about history and African culture and so on. And then another influence here in Kansas City was Kansas City Harmony's work that they've done and the work of the Urban League, where they had the dialogues of using that book, What White and Black People Need to Know About Each Other. It was called Afraid of the Dark. They had a series of dialogue groups that over the course of a couple of years that just really opened my perspective, and I thought that was a useful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The American Pictures that June refers to is a lecture on racism, oppression, poverty, and injustice by Jacob Holt. More than 20,000 pictures of racism and poverty and white hate groups during that pivotal civil rights period. It's sort of almost like a Clockwork Orange sit down, make you force and see the racism, forces you to see the racism. And American Pictures is what June talks about, gave an impression, seeing it up close. There was recently another exhibit out in Bonner Springs about the African-American experience through the lens, viewing the hoses and viewing the marches and viewing the lynchings and seeing Emmett Till in the casket. That must bring something home for you as a Chicagoan as well.
Absolutely.
Tell us about your background in geography and anthropology, two areas of study that seem like an interesting mix. How do you employ that background in the work that you now do?
They were employed in what was really cultural geography, how people impact place, shape place, how place can shape people as well. Sometimes those are natural environments, such as the low country of South Carolina and Georgia, which people think of as a natural environment. It's actually a radically transformed environment. Using African technologies and African know-how, over 250 years, it was changed from sort of mucky, muddy swampland to some of the most productive rice-producing agricultural regions in the world, with a very expensive, high-end kind of crop. But there's nothing natural about it. And it was unknown in Europe over this period. This is a cultural landscape. And so not only the people, the languages, et cetera, but the natural resources in that environment merit close consideration and preservation. On the other hand, the Project Row Houses in Houston, which is a community in the 7th Ward, 3rd Ward of shotgun houses, a particularly distinctive African, Afro-Caribbean, Southern kind of architecture, is a cultural landscape people think of it as just a working class neighborhood, but that architecture, the building skills, the building arts that go into it are extremely unique. They were historically furthered through apprenticeship and formal teaching, and they are under preservation and reinterpretation even now. So these are examples of, in a sense, cultural geography and history and place and people, even in the 21st century, having great importance and resonance.
Dr. Mack, your career trajectory seems to virtually form a list of sites folks should probably visit around the country. Tell us about your travels to exhibits and sites around the country and what struck you the most. Some of those sites that you saw.
There are, you know, I think of them as places of memory that are sort of fundamental touchstones for the American experience. And some of them are environments and places. The Okefenokee Swamp, St. Augustine, Florida, which was the site of Fort Mose, some of the earliest emancipation action of African Americans under the Spanish colonial presence. The city of Charleston looks the way it does because of Africans and African Americans. It is quite definitively an African cultural landscape and a very important place. But on the other hand, so is New York and Wall Street, which was built by enslaved Africans under the Dutch colonial presence, when Wall Street was a wall and was constructed of timbers that were felled and hewn and put in place by enslaved Africans. But there are also, you know, profound churches. These are not always big and shall we say, well-known places. If it's a community touchstone, it's an important place.
When you hear an African-American say, we built this country or we helped build this country, some of the sites you're talking about, some of the architecture, some of the masonry and the brickwork and
the railroads, the canals, the literal physical construction. But also we have to remember that when Africans arrived and African-Americans, they often came empty-handed, but they did not come empty-headed. The technologies around that, the family structures, the learning structures, the apprenticeship systems, the formal instructions that came with that are part of from the very earliest moment that you start in the Americas here. There's an African hand in it. What we eat, how we walk, how Americans speak. We forget all of that because it's so commonplace in many respects. But the scholarship, the places, and of course the regional variety of that, which we also tend to forget with the African American presence, is it's an ongoing litany that's always delightful.
Speaking of regional variety, many of our listeners might be interested in your work you did in Denver, the Western Legacy Project at the Blair Caldwell African American Research Library in Denver. How did that come to fruition?
That came to fruition because the Denver Public Library, which is a huge and incredibly successful public library system, was developing a public library branch in Five Points, a neighborhood that was historically African-American. And they had decided to develop an African-American archive as part of the legacy of that. And then they decided to add a museum and exhibits because they discovered that many visitors and actually many residents in Denver said that, oh, African-Americans came around World War II. They came after the Civil War. Well, we begin in 1527 with the African presence in the West, landing in what is now just offshore of Houston, and with Esteban Nico, who comes with the Spanish. And he is the Spanish scout for 3 years, going ahead of the Spanish as they move forward into what becomes later on Mexico, and then later, even later, the United States into Colorado. And so talking about that range of experience and engagement in many places over time in the American West is something that was important to the Denver Public Library in terms of the resources they had, but also in terms of educating their audiences.
And also in terms of the local history. And local history is very important.
Absolutely.
How is local history and education as a segue to understanding history in our country and our world, how is that important?
Most people can begin to connect with the past or even with the present from where they live, from their own family narratives, their neighborhood, their communities, their town, their city. If you can begin in that way and understand the importance of how this comes to be, how you know what you know, what are the sources of evidence, you begin to realize how that has impact as you go further out. It also helps one to really develop a distinction between what one is told is history and what your understanding is of how that comes to be. It's sort of the beginnings of critical inquiry and critical thinking.
Carl in Raytown, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. I was listening to the your program, and, I became enlightened of Black history when I was a sophomore in high school. I had a teacher by the name of Dr. Stacy Hopkins. And he talked quite a bit about Afro-American history. And then further on in life, you know, I lived in Chicago, and I went around a lot of the Black venues there. And then, you know, I got a hold of a lot of books like Message to the Black Man in America by Elijah Muhammad, The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson, and J.A. Rogers' Sex and Race, Nature Knows No Color Line. So, you know, there's a very vibrant history. The Moors of Spain. You know, so there's a lot of books and there's a lot of information out there, especially now, regarding our history. And I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carl, for contributing to the conversation on where you first learn the most about African-American history and culture. 816-235-2888 is the number. That's 816-235-2888. Lanisa Robinson in KC writes in to say, last year, my young son and I learned a great deal about the history in a very fun way. In a play starring Danny Cox, it was a play about the Monarchs, the Negro League baseball team of Kansas City, and the play itself was awesome, but equally educational was the question and answer period after the play. Theater for Young America really brought this history to life for us. For some people, it's books. For some people, it's the oral history experience. Dr. Matt?
One saying that we have in the museum world is that you meet your visitors where they are and take them to the next level. That also means that people don't all learn in the same way. Some people learn through reading, others through experience, others through storytelling. And there are multiple ways in which we can address this subject matter, address the lessons, the stories, the histories, without making it, quote unquote, a history lesson.
Our guest is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director for Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian and the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Kansas City, where did you first learn most about the African American history and culture? Is there a museum, a book, or a speaker that has left an impact on you and how you see the world? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're going into a quick break. When we return, we continue our discussion on local history's role in education and the role Dr. Mack feels institutions such as the Black Archives of Mid-America and the Smithsonian should play on the local, regional, and national stage. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. America cannot understand its own history unless the African-American experience is embraced as a central factor in shaping who we are and what we have become as Americans. Those are the words of Dr. Lonnie Bunch, founding director at the Smithsonian National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington. And we now continue our discussion with one of the people responsible for selecting Dr. Bunch in his capacity as director of that institution, which is set to open in 2015. Our guest is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director for Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian Institution and the National Museum of African American History and Culture. In celebration of the grand opening of the Black Archives of Mid-America today, Dr. Mack will be speaking later at 6 p.m. at the Gym Theater, 1615 East 18th Street in the 18th and Vine District. The event is free and open to the public. More information is available on our website at kcur.org. Meanwhile, Kansas City, we've been asking you, where did you learn the most significant piece of African-American history that left an indelible impression on you? Did you learn it in a museum or a book or a speaker or a film? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Ellen Murphy writes, as a 54-year-old Tulsa native, she'd like to see the 1921 Tulsa riot covered by the Smithsonian. Didn't know about it until she was in her 20s. Was raised in North Tulsa where it happened, and the treatment would give it the national exposure it deserves. She's referring to the bombing of what was called Black Wall Street in Tulsa in the 1920s. Stories like that that are rarely told during Black History Month. What do you think of that?
Well, actually, the Tulsa riot, the larger story of that community, what happened during the riots and the aftermath, is one of the stories that we are featuring. We actually have been fortunate enough to have the cooperation of individuals and families who have material culture, oral histories, images, etc. And so we have collections from that event, from that horrific event. And it will be one of the stories that we profile in the National Museum.
Mitzi in KC, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. And thank you very much for this very interesting program. The first place I have really become interested in the impact of all cultures working together has been some of the military channels, World War II history. And we don't hear enough about the contribution of the Negro race in the Black man's participation, and it couldn't have happened without it. And I'm just very sad that we somehow have to have something special for something that is so important to everyday life of all of us. It's just too bad that we can't have a history book that includes, you know, all of the, not just the Tuskegee Airmen, but all of those people who took care of all of the food and all of the gasoline and all the things that had to make the, you know, behind the scenes of the war. We never talk about that. We don't talk about how important the changes in, like you were saying a moment ago, the railroad. We couldn't have gotten across the country without the contributions of all people, not just white people. And I find it very sad that we just have to do something special. It should be part of us all of the time. But thank you, and I'm very glad that you're bringing this to our attention.
I was going to ask Mitzi what she meant by special, but talk about Mitzi's comments.
Well, what Mitzi is referring to has been the historical reality in this country, and that until maybe this current generation of school-age children, African-Americans and many other people were simply not included in the major canon and the primary narrative. That has changed and continues to change, and I think that it's an excellent sign. In itself, it is not enough, but it is an excellent opportunity. It's interesting that she does mention, however, for instance, with highlighting the Tuskegee Airmen in films, et cetera, if you actually go to the Tuskegee Airmen's national site, there is a lot of information and really the voices of the women, for instance, who were the mechanics, who were the parachute riggers. There's also a contextualization of the airmen themselves, who were just a very small percentage of the larger effort, within the communities that they came from. That is as important, in a sense, as a social history as anything else, talking about what their backgrounds were, where they came from, what they contributed to their communities during and the aftermath.
Allison in Kansas City, Missouri writes, she's currently reading the most enlightening book. What she says is enlightening, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration by Isabel Wilkerson. This fascinating book traces the migration of Black Americans from the Jim Crow South to northern cities from about 1915 through the 70s. She says she's definitely learning more about American history that was never covered in class. The Great Migration is one of those pivotal events in history, and you've covered that as an anthropologist and cultural geographer. But there's a new Great Migration happening. Tell us about that.
The return migration to the South, you know, I'm a product, of course, of that first 40-year Great Migration. My grandfather left Mississippi, the youngest of 10 children and the first in his family to go to Chicago, and all of his siblings followed. Some 70 years later, many of us are returning to the South. And it was somewhere in the early 1980s, and I can't remember the actual year, when the documentation and the evidence began to point out that the return migration of African Americans to the South actually exceeded the original numbers of people and families, entire communities often, that left the South. There was a huge impact then that has really resonated throughout the 20th century on the South and, in fact, on the rest of the country, because that change, that demographic change, impacted industry, education, residents, everything throughout all of America. This return migration has had huge impact as well on the South, becoming now one of the leading economic regions of the United States. and in part because of many people going south, but many African Americans who return to very small communities, often historical communities of origin, and they bring with them 2, 3, sometimes 4 generations of expertise, income, professional development and ability, and engagement, long-term engagement with those home communities, which they still call home. And so the face of the 21st century South is a very different, very engaging, very inviting place of opportunity in ways that the North per se no longer is.
And you said the numbers of people going back to the South of African-American origin or descent or of diasporatic origin have now exceeded the numbers of the original Great Migration.
That's true.
What reasons are we finding for this sort of return from that previous exodus?
There are a range of reasons, one of them being a need to reconnect to assist family that is still there. Part of it is economic choice. By and large, people have choice now, which they did not in the original migration. And it's a return to a preferential culture, lifestyle, values, a way of living. You know, Southern culture is, by and large, African-American culture. And the food ways, the ways that people deal with each other, address each other, respect each other, and then weather has a lot to do with it, I sometimes think as well, once you've gone through Chicago winters. There is something that is familiar, that is known familiarly. There is family land or family property often involved, not always, but very often. And a value system. It's also an opportunity for many people to feel that they can make a contribution.
In the sense of being, as they say, down home.
Absolutely.
This is home for many people.
Absolutely.
Sauti in Kansas City, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, Javelani?
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. All of us.
My contribution is that I learned about my heritage actually by accident, first by listening to jazz music, and I'm from, like, Leavenworth, Kansas, and my parents were void of any information about our ancestry and about our history. And when I joined the Marine Corps in 1960, I started seeing little articles. By the time I got out in 64, J.A. Rogers was my big influence. And from there, I started looking for more information and broadening my scope. But what I noticed was that we don't tend to collect data about our ancestry and our neighborhood. So we don't collect and keep photographs to document who we are, where we are, for a big part, especially in the northern part. And I visit museums across the United States, and the things that you can find in the museums are fabulous. However, very few people, people of color, visit the museums. I've been to about 4 museums in Baltimore, Maryland, a couple in Philadelia. I go to Tulsa on a pilgrimage by every year to see Green Street and Black Wall Street. And I even visit the Oklahoma, the newspaper down in Tulsa that was there in 1921.
Thank you for your contribution to the conversation. How important is it for museums such as the Smithsonian and our very own Black Archives of Mid-America to also be strong research institutions, Dr. Mack?
Well, the caller makes points to something which is not just an African-American phenomenon. It's a human phenomenon. People tend to take for granted what they grow up with. There are unusual individuals who do collect newspaper articles, et cetera, but unless you have been conscious about it for some specific reason, you tend to think of this as just your normal everyday life. The Black Archives of Mid-America is particularly important because these are professionals who do this. They do it with the skills that are needed, with the resources that are needed. They understand the shortfalls in documentation and collecting. They actually perform a critical service in that they compile the evidence of how we know what we know. They also, especially in the 21st century, and this is where the Black Archives is already ahead of the curve, are immediately able to disseminate through digital means, through teacher workshops and teacher institutes, through public programs with communities and beyond, why this is important, how the public can get engaged in this, how they can better take care of the inheritance that they have.
You mentioned the digital reach in the aspect of research. African American history is now one of the more popular areas of study in the African diaspora, in Africa in particular. Talk about the growth in interest of African American history overseas.
Not only is it very popular as a mainstream field in this country, but African American studies, for instance, in Africa has been the fastest growing, shall we call it, academic area of concentration for university students for nearly a decade. African American studies, and by this I mean U.S., although it can be beyond that, is a major, is a field of study of huge interest, so that when, for instance, the Black Archives of Mid-America digitizes and makes digitally available through various mechanisms these materials, students at the University of Dakar in Senegal or the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa can access this for research, for papers, for master's theses, for dissertations. And beyond that as well, educators are, in many of these countries, are developing as part of their own research groups their curriculum. It is these materials, and because of their access to them, that they can incorporate this information, that they have evidence for building curriculum.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director for Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian Institution and the National Museum for African American History and Culture, set to open in 2015. Kansas City, where did you learn the most about African American history and culture? Is there a museum or a book or a film or a speaker that's left an impact on you? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also holler at us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tiffany in Leavenworth. Hello, Tiffany.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. I just wanted to say thank you for your subject matter. It's a very informative show today. And the thing that impacted me the most in, my interest in my history was probably my family. We have regular family reunions, and my family, gosh, we're in Georgia, Texas, Indianapolis, San Jose, California. I mean, we're all over the place. And, what had happened is we decided that we were going to see if we could compile all the history about our family that we had available to us, and we ended up with a family tree, a really informative slideshow, and all this took place when I was about, 16 or so, and I have to say that it really, influenced me in, wanting to know more about our history as African Americans, and I feel like I was very blessed and lucky to have, my family, to be, that many people to be interested, to the sense where they would go. We have, an amazing family tree that we can reference and look at, and, we know that we don't have specifics. However, we have pictures. We know that, freed slaves came to Kansas to become farmers, and, it's just a beautiful legacy to have, and I'm very thankful that my family, decided that they were going to make our history important, because I think very early on, my grandmother and my grandfather, they always knew that, our history was important, and that if somebody was going to preserve it, it was going to have to be us. Nobody was going to help us to do that. So, we held on to what we could throughout the years, and luckily we have a hold of a lot of it. And, I was listening to the caller earlier that was, talking about how we don't, keep our history, we don't write it down or, pay too much attention to it. And that is very true. And like I said, I know I'm blessed and very lucky to have a family that at least kept a hold of some of that history so that, we could share it with future generations. So
Thank you very much, Tiffany. How important is the research, the artifacts, and history of a given place, whether it be Kansas City or Leavenworth, like our caller? What does this history tell us about where we are now?
Well, these are all resources. These are all tools that could help any individual or any individual family. It provides more evidence, more background. The documents, for instance, at the Black Archives can help an individual such as this caller, most recent caller. She said something very interesting, that they knew about freed slaves who come to Kansas, but she did make an oblique reference to what we call the Great Divide, 1865. Where for the overwhelming majority of people, there are no documents because we were not documented. And where we were, it's often as property. There has been a huge advance in that kind of information through organizations like the Black Archives, through genealogical organizations and research. This is really research-based work. Much, much more is available. And in fact, one of the milestones happened this last spring in April. The Freedmen's Bureau records were made available for the very first time digitally. This is a
That was the government bureau that helped slaves adjust to their new status.
That's right. And in order to claim land, to have a job or anything, individuals had to come forward and provide information. But that information was very comprehensive. This is where we get where people lived, their parents' names, their siblings' names, where they have bank records, all of this kind of thing that provides a lot of depth and basically histories of individuals and their expanded families that really help us identify many more people.
Dr. Mack, speaking of 1865 and the events leading up to 1865 and after 1865, Juneteenth we celebrated this week on June 19th. Tell us about the significance of the Juneteenth celebration. June 19th, 1865, slaves in Texas found out they were actually free 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Why does that endure to this day? And why has it spread beyond Texas? It's very popular here in Kansas City as well.
It's very popular. It's an observance that has become embraced by many people and many communities around the country, although it is Texas specific. I think that is an acknowledgement of, first of all, we understand how slow communications were and also that people were in outlying areas. This was not exactly, shall we say, front page news that owners and former owners of slaves wanted to see disseminated. But the acknowledgement of that historical reality and its impact is something that communities have really just picked up to, in a sense, to pat on the back, and it's an endorsement of the difficulties. Freedom was not an overnight or instantaneous event. It was a process. And unfreedom returned for a very long time in the form of Jim Crow segregation.
And black codes and peonage and everything absolutely. Else.
Absolutely. So the construction era. Yeah. So it's 1865, but it's another 100 years before 1965 happens, where that freedom is actually codified into law. One reason that the National Museum of African American History and Culture is opening in 2015 is in recognition of 1865. It will be 150 years.
Do you have plans to either advise or work in concert with the Black Archives of Mid-America in the coming months and years in your capacity at the Smithsonian?
Specifically with the Black Archives, we've already begun discussions because the Black Archives of Mid-America is an absolute excellent model for the way that many of the archives, libraries, and other organizations that collect this evidence can work not only with their community but with their peer organizations. The National Museum is actually in conversation to develop, in a sense, a needs assessment and to talk to the Black Archives here and with a number of others about how we can best serve and expand the work they do.
What is the focus of your teacher workshop today?
The teacher workshop, and actually this is an initiative of the Black Archives here, is a two-day workshop on really revisioning the Kansas City narrative and the Kansas narrative. And that means, what are the new questions that are being asked, the new sources of evidence? How do we more effectively teach this in a broad way? And how do we collaborate in developing the lines of research and inquiry that need to go into these better and fuller explanations? What are the new resources?
There are seats left for this teacher's workshop, by the way. If you want more information, go to kcur.org and you can get information about that workshop later today. How do you revision or re-envision African-American history and keep the flame going, so to speak?
African-American history and culture is as relevant and as central to not only what it was to be an American in the past as it is today and will be in the future. The information keeps coming. The vision, and I should say visions, diversify and expand. What we're also doing is not only talking about being an African-American in this country today, but we will talk about what it is to be African-American in the world at the National Museum.
Dr. Mack, we ask this question of a lot of experts on black culture, the question of black history and Black History Month. In this day and age with a black president and conditions arguably better than they were in the thick of the civil rights era, do you feel differently about Black History Month?
Black History Month will always be an opportunity for us to raise up and highlight ongoing and changing issues, to reach back to the past, yes, but to deal with the realities of today and those of the future. The questions and issues that Carter G. Woodson imagined should be raised in public discussion and in a public forum originally have resonance today, and we continue to add to that list and to change that. What is it to be African American in the 21st century is something that we should all wonder about, and what does it mean to be an American as a global citizen in the 21st century? An African American lens and perspective on that is, I believe, still a very critical and seminal lens.
Our guest is Dr. Deborah Mack, the Associate Director of Community and Constituent Services at the Smithsonian Institution and the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. In celebration of the grand opening or re-grand opening of the Black Archives of Mid-America, Dr. Mack will be speaking today at the Gym Theater, 1615 East 18th Street in the 18th and Vine District at 6 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. More info on that event is at our website at kcur.org. Dr. Mack, thank you for joining us today on Central Standard.
Thank you for inviting me.
And tune in tomorrow when we air out a discussion about the U.S. Regional Air Guitar Championships coming to KC this Friday with an air shredding vengeance. That plus a look at our Kansas City maker community and their Fab Lab. It's fabulous. Our show is produced by Andreas Lindsay with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at detection, treatment, and recovery from stroke. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.